Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
What does the quote, love your neighbor as thyself, mean to you?
Wait, let me think about it first.
I guess that quote is a Christian quote.
Like, if you put good energy into the world, you're gonna get it back.
Having empathy for the people around you.
I didn't grow up, like, religious or anything, but I guess it just means treat people with compassion, right? If you approach every interaction with an open heart, maybe you can feel a little bit of what they're going through.
I guess people who don't really love themselves as much tend to treat others the same way they treat themselves, poorly.
What does loving yourself mean?
Cherishing the temple you're stuck with.
Practicing self-care.
What does it mean for the communal good?
A society where everyone is only looking out for yourself is bound to fail. So for the collective good, we can all look out for each other a little bit more and be a little bit more pro-social.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. The Golden Rule. It's one of the most widely known, maybe widely misunderstood, tenets of many faith traditions. It's also one that guided the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr. So tonight, on the eve of MLK Day, we're going to unpack the big ideas embedded in those little words, love thy neighbor as thyself. And let me say that the national celebration of King's legacy has rarely felt so loaded with meaning as it does to me this week. Last year, 19 states passed dozens of new laws restricting access to the vote. The Brennan Center says that's more than any year since it's been tracking voting bills. And some say it's the most significant constriction of democracy we've seen since the Civil Rights Movement. And there are more bills coming. So later in the show, we'll meet one of the college students from Arizona who are now on a second hunger strike alongside a group of faith leaders, and they're demanding passage of new federal legislation to protect the right to vote. Right now, I am joined by the Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis, pastor of Middle Church here in New York. She's been among the faith leaders advocating for voting rights legislation, and she's also built her whole ministry around the idea that love of both thyself and thy neighbor is the necessary first act of revolution. She's the author of a new book called Fierce Love, A Bold Path to Ferocious Courage and Rule-Breaking Kindness That Can Heal the World. Reverend Lewis, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I suppose we need to start by defining what you mean by this word love. In your book, you start off by sharing the idea of Ubuntu, which comes from the Zulu in Southern Africa. What is Ubuntu?
Ubuntu is this incredibly old, probably older than many of the world's religions, Kai, philosophy that comes to fruition in the cradle of civilization, right, in South Africa. And it is a Zulu Bantu saying, Ubuntu, Ubuntu, Ubuntu. I learned that for you, Kai. A person is a person through other people. A human is a human through other humans. Mm-hmm. This idea is that we are inextricably connected one to the other. Mandela, in prison, learned to appreciate the humanity of his captors. He was saying, Kai, they weren't born hating him. They learned to hate him. And because they did, they could learn to love him. Bishop Tutu, bless his heart, bless his soul, really put Ubuntu on the table in the Truth and Reconciliation movement. But it is this idea that I am not human all by myself. When Zulu people see each other, they say, Sawubona, which means I see you. And the response is Sikona, which means I exist. So there's a conversation about being. There's a transforming moment that says, because you see me, I am here, and we are here together. Isn't that beautiful?
It is, and there's a duality there that's built into this phrase, love thy neighbor as thyself, right? It's
correct.
Dual.
Yeah.
And you also write that when that duality is removed from the conversation, religion becomes toxic.
That's absolutely right. And as you said, Kai, at the top of the hour, almost every major religion has this teaching, right? In Judaism, it comes from Leviticus, you know, you are not to ignore a stranger. In fact, you're to love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. The Quran says, don't withhold something from someone that you need for yourself. The Sikh tradition says, don't break anyone else's heart. All around is this idea of love neighbor as self. And I think your young guest is saying, maybe what's wrong with the world is we're actually following that rule. Maybe we don't love ourselves, and therefore we're loving our neighbors in the poor way that we love ourselves. Mm. And I just think that's my hypothesis, that when we don't really find a way to love, I mean really love, not have affection for, but really have an unconditional regard for the parts of ourselves that are untenable, about which we feel ashamed or embarrassed, we can't love the strangeness of the stranger. We can't love the otherness of the other. So the rehearsal ground for a compassionate, revolutionary world is self-love.
I want to quote how you talk about that in the book. There's a passage where you say, you ask, how many folks low on self-love take to social media to post and say horrible things? Are they making decisions about budgets and policies, policing cities and towns while running empty on self-love? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, that's the kind of thing I have to say that people say as a kind of rhetorical device, but I gather you mean it quite literally.
I mean it quite literally. As a girl child, Black, who grew up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, in the container of the United States, Kai, where you grow up, where it's hard to love a self, frankly, right? The container is toxic. I'm called the N-word for the first time when I'm a baby in kindergarten. People's parents are traumatized, therefore their children are traumatized. And that's Black folks. So when I think about white folks whose, let's say, foundational story is we leave, you know, Europe in search of the land of the free and the home of the brave. We come here, find a land inhabited by indigenous people, but think they're not human enough to regard. We harvest Black lives off the soul of Africa and think they're not human. My core thesis is those people who were dissed, we might say, who were disenfranchised in Europe already had a hole in their souls. Mm. And they come here with a hole in their souls and they build a culture that is built on power over, on land grabbing, on lies and oppression, because maybe where there should be a soul, there's a hole.
In the Christian tradition, the golden rule comes from the parable of the Good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. Jesus tells a religious leader to love thyself as thy neighbor. And when the leader asks for clarification on the term neighbor, Jesus tells this story. He says, a man is robbed and beaten and left for dead. The pious walk by and leave him there, but a Samaritan, which is to say someone at the time considered to be an enemy of the Jewish people, stops to help.
That's
you
right.
Tell your own version of an encounter with a good Canadian, I guess.
Yes, I do.
Can you tell that story and what we're to take from it?
Oh my gosh, I will. In fact, I'm a theologian, so I've known this Samaritan story forever, but to live it really in my life was transformational. I'm a young woman right out of college, driving across Canada on the way to a wedding with the boy I loved at the time. And as we changed seats, something happened. All the air went out of one of our tires and the car slid across four lanes in a highway, the Queen Elizabeth Way. And miraculously, we don't hit a car, but I flipped the wheel all the way back to the right to get the car straight. And the G-forces, I'm not a scientist, but I'll tell you that my stomach flipped before the car did. It spun around three times and then bounced tire roof, with the sunroof off. When we landed, glass and gravel, blood and torn sinews in my boy's hand, my boyfriend's hand, but we were alive. The ambulance comes and takes us to the hospital in Windsor, Canada. And I call him Paul in the book, is kept overnight because his injuries are serious and mine aren't. We're college kids. We just graduate. We got no money. We got no credit card. We are broke, really, on a shoestring. And I have to call our parents and tell them the bad news. And I'm just finally overwhelmed, standing at a phone bank, crying. And I look up to see a petite white lady staring at me. I'm sure I'm a fright. Big afro, imagine glass in it, blood on the jacket. But she just walks to me and just says, you know, what's wrong and how can I help you? And no kidding, I can see her coat. I can see her shoes. Of course, I knew her name and I can't ever retrieve it. But she was lovely and she took me to get food and took me to the drugstore to get aspirin and cleaning supplies, took me to a hotel, checked me in, paid my way, picked me up the next morning, took me to get a car, a rental car, took me back to the hospital so I could pick up Paul and drive us home. It was
all this with a stranger.
And you know what? I'm a black girl and she's a white lady and both of us are breaking the rules. This is the parallel I make with this kind of rule-breaking kindness, right? She's not supposed to pick up a woman that she doesn't know either. I'm not supposed to get in a car. I grew up in Chicago. But here we are, both of us kind of having this transgressive, wild experience of extravagant love. She saved me that night, Kai. And in a way, honestly, but the theology that had been theoretical in my heart forever as a real lived ethic, that love actually does break the rules, cross the street, cross the border, is transgressive and rule breaking. And that's actually what's going to make friends out of enemies. And that's what's going to heal us.
And you describe these kinds of moments as creating transitional spaces in which transformation can happen.
Right.
But how so, and why should I even seek such a transformation?
Well, because we're living in a hot mess, aren't we, friend? I mean, we don't have to seek transformation, but I think good people everywhere are mourning the state of our union, not just the state of the United States, but the brokenness of the globe where immigration patterns threaten white people, where power is brokered in crazy ways and the political stage, where the very ones who received the blessing of a safe new place to live want to withhold that at the southern border. It's insane. So here's what I want to say. All of us become human. I'm a psychologist and a theologian, Kai, and all of us become human in what psychologists call a container. Your mother's womb, the space in your family, your nana's knee, your titi's, you know, kitchen, kindergarten, all of those are the transitional spaces where we become human. Your classroom, the playground, you know, church, synagogue, mosque, the basketball court, you know, all of those are spaces where we become human because of the relationships we build and the stories we encounter. So what I'm wanting to say is that if we want a better world for our children, if we want the world to heal, we need to create these spaces of these brave and safe spaces where we tell the truth to each other, where we take a look at our own stories and try to make new ones together, where we do not deny the brokenness in our history, but looking at it straight on, we think to ourselves, what's the trajectory that will make it better for all of us? And to go back to Ubuntu for a second, where we think your self-interest and my self-interest are the same. Clean water, good air to breathe, enough food, enough clothing. Who doesn't think that we deserve that? All of us. And if we put our minds and love on it, we can build it together.
I'm talking with Reverend Jackie Lewis, senior minister of Middle Church and author of the new book, Fierce Love, A Bold Path to Ferocious Courage and Rule-Making Kindness That Can Heal the World. We'll be right back.
Now, first, let us deal with this question, which is the practical question. How do you go about loving your enemies? I think the first thing is this. In order to love your enemies, you must begin by analyzing self. Now, I'm sure that seems strange to you that I start out telling you this morning that you love your enemies by beginning with a look at self. It seems to me that that is the first and foremost way to come to an adequate discovery to the how of this situation.
Hey, this is Kusha. I'm a producer. Last week, we asked you how anxious you are about the state of our democracy from 1 to 10. Here's what one of you had to say.
Hey, Kai. My name's Jordan, and I live in Park Slope. I would say right now, I'm about a 7, but I'm a 7 with some optimism. I just went to my first community board meeting, and as a 30-year-old, I feel pretty optimistic, inspired by the action of our city, where quite differently from the news I hear in the national headlines, we have problems that I can understand and have an opinion about that are totally disconnected from the hyper-partisanship that I see in the national news. I think for me, local politics and nonpartisan issues about people that I can talk to and understand are what makes me think that although the national scene is pretty fraught, we still got this city and we still have our neighbors. Thanks.
Thanks, Jordan, and everyone who's listening and talking to us, too. If you've got something to say, send us a message to anxiety@wnyc.org. That's anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks.
Some people aren't going to like you because your skin is a little brighter than theirs. Others aren't going to like you because your skin is a little darker than theirs. So that some people aren't going to like you. They're going to dislike you not because of something that you've done to them, but because of various jealous reactions and other reactions that are so prevalent in human nature. But after looking at these things and admitting these things, we must face the fact that an individual might dislike us because of something that we've done deep down in the past, some personality attribute that we possess, something that we've done deep down in the past and we've forgotten about it, but it was that something that aroused the hate response within the individual. That is why I say begin with yourself.
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm joined by Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis, whose ministry at Middle Church here in New York is rooted in the idea that love of self and of others as thyself, that this is a crucial step in creating a more perfect union. And Reverend Lewis, we heard those clips of Martin Luther King Jr. coming in and out of the break talking about loving your enemy and examining yourself first. And I think that this part of King's message is the one that's often embraced by people who prefer to see him as only a healer, not as a radical, as something a little less threatening. And so I just wonder, can you speak to that dynamic and what do you hear in that part of King's message?
Yeah, I think this is the part of King's message that made people criticize him. In his book, this wonderful book, Testament of Hope, with all kinds of his writings in there, he has a couple of interviews where he's kind of pushed back around that. And people remind him that that Malcolm X had a criticism of him at first, Kenneth Clark, a Black psychologist. But actually, I think this part of King's message is part of his fiercest message. And he's defining love the way I defined it. He wasn't talking about affection. He wasn't talking about going to dinner with folks. He wasn't talking about, having tea parties. He was saying that this kind of love is agape, an unconditional regard kind of love, a love that is more about seeking understanding. And to be honest, King was reading a lot of psychology when he was doing this work, a book by Eric Fromm on the art of loving, a white psychoanalyst. King was reading and kind of really deeply moved by it. And what I would say as a psychologist also is, if you flip the script, if you say to yourself, why do white people hate black people? When you say that, why do some white people hate black people? And if I say, well, what it is that they hate the part of themselves that's like that black person, right? They hate the part of themselves. Why do straight people, they hate gay people? Well, they fear the part of themselves that they think might be gay. That's a hypothesis we can go, oh, that makes sense. But I think when we flip it back around and change the colors of the actors, it seems a little harder to digest. Mm-hmm. But for every human who has a huge reaction to another, I would say there's something in the self. There's something in the self that's responding to the self of the other. Mm-hmm. They're fearful. I'm jealous. I'm resentful. I think they're too much like me. I think they want my stuff. That's what King is describing. And I think it's really, we see it on the playground with little babies. So yeah. It's true, this kind of desire to annihilate that which you also actually admire. So it is a strong truth that invites a self-critique to say, how am I causal in this relationship with this other person? What's my role in the hatred?
What's my role in the hatred? Ouch.
Ouch.
Another important thinker on the intersection of love and politics was Bell Hooks.
Yes.
Just died before the new year.
Yes, sir.
And you opened one of the chapters of your book with a quote from her. How did she impact your work, I gather?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this sister was fierce, and her call to love really changed my life. A queer Black woman really putting out there in the world in a vulnerable way that it isn't hatred, it isn't violence, it isn't demanding that's going to get us where we want to go. There's a self-reflection, there's a self-analysis, and a self-love that causes ripples of love in the world. I love her ideas of how to get to reconciliation by doing truth work. So deeply impacted by her writings.
Let's hear from Carla in Inwood. Carla, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Reverend Lewis, how can we love our neighbors when our neighbors have done horrific things, who have caused, like, for example, the deaths of at least 15 people, the injuries of dozens more by the people who owned the building in the Bronx, the fire that happened this past week, and the 100 families displaced. And this is a result of, negligence, not spending enough money to make sure that the building was properly maintained.
Yep.
Carla, for time, I'm going to stop you there and let Reverend Lewis answer because we're short on time. Go ahead,
Carla. First of all, giant grief we're feeling at our church for those deaths. One of my deacons was up there today at the funeral. So again, the way we define love here isn't I have affection for, it isn't I want to go dancing with. It's a kind of regard for their humanity that leads to understanding. And this is a nonviolent response. You might not know, Carla, but our church burned down last year to the ground because of negligence of our neighbor. And I'm just saying to you, I don't want to play with that woman. I don't want to go dancing with that woman, but I seek to understand her humanity as a way to understand my own. I seek to understand her motive. I want to understand what makes her tick, frankly, so I can transform her and our dynamic. And I think that's what King meant, and I know that's what I mean. It is not reasonable to expect us to go, to tea parties with the people who wound us. But it is an interesting act of faith in God to see that they also belong to God and to wonder about them, have curiosity about them, to pay attention to what about them caused that behavior so we can see if we can make it better.
And how do you, my question that's sort of an add-on to Carla is about sustaining that kind of thing. You know, I mean, speaking for myself, you know, just Kai, COVID alone has revealed to me just how malevolently selfish people can be.
Absolutely, and, Kai. Yeah.
You know, and so how do you sustain this idea that you should lead with love rather than self-defense or counterattack in the face of this onslaught?
I don't think we sustain it. I think it comes and goes. I think it ebbs and flows. If I'm honest, I think it's aspirational. If I'm honest, I think when I decide to feel hateful on a day, Kai, somebody like you needs to hold the love. We got to pass the love baton around because we're human. So I'm not trying to be namby-pammy, pie in the sky. I'm trying to say it is a fierce kind of love that caused King to go to Memphis to stand up for the sanitation workers when he knew his life was in danger. That's what it is. It's the kind of love that makes people wade in the fetid waters when the dams break in New Orleans. It's that kind of love. It's the kind of love that made that Samaritan stop and deal with the bloody dudes on the street when the religious people wouldn't. It isn't an everyday easy thing. It's a force. That's why it's fierce.
And about the minute we've got left, we're going to talk about voting rights in the next part of the show, and we'll meet a young activist who's putting her body on the line in the democracy fight. Thinking about this well of sustaining in particular, what do you have thoughts for particularly people who haven't lived through a time like this and have been asked to make these kinds of choices?
Yeah, I have and have watched over a way that with tears has been watered, the John Lewis's and Ella Baker's and Martin King's and Fannie Lou Hamer's and my Uncle George Jordan, regular folks, y'all, regular folks, 7-year-old kids who suited up in their Sunday best and marched across the bridge, who went through the trainings, who did the hard work. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until all of us are free. And that sacrifice is an act of love. It's a sacrifice to call your senators. It's a sacrifice to join the places where people are doing movement building. It's a sacrifice to demand the passing of the John Lewis Act. It's a sacrifice to stay engaged when we want to feel numb and pulled in. Because if we don't vote and if we don't demand the vote, what our ancestors died for is in vain. So I'm calling us to that kind of selflessness that keeps us moving even when we're tired, marching to freedom together.
Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis is pastor of Middle Church here in New York. She's author of a new book titled Fierce Love, A Bold Path to Ferocious Courage and Rule-Breaking Kindness That Can Heal the World. Thank you so very much for joining us and for your work and your ministry, Reverend Lewis.
Thank you so much, Kai, for this amazing show. Appreciate you.
Up next, we're going to meet one of the Arizona college students who are now on a second hunger strike, demanding new federal legislation to protect the right to vote. Stay with us.
So somehow the isness of our present natures is out of harmony with the eternal oughtness that forever confronts us. And this simply means this, that within the best of us there is some evil. And within the worst of us, there is some good. When we come to see this, we take a different attitude toward individuals. The person who hates you most has some good in him. Even the nation that hates you most has some good in it. Even the race that hates you most has some good in it. And when you come to the point that you look in the face of every man and see deep down within him what religion calls the image of God, you begin to love him in spite of, no matter what he does, you see God's image there. And that is an element of goodness that he can never slough off. Discover the element of good in your enemy. And as you seek to hate him, find the center of goodness and place your attention there, and you will take a new attitude.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Democracy is the greatest form of government, to my mind, that man has ever conceived. But the weakness is that we have never practiced it. Isn't it true that we have often taken necessities from the masses to give luxuries to the classes? Isn't it true that we have often, in our democracy, trampled over individuals and races with the iron feet of oppression?
Martin Luther King Day was the deadline that Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer set for bringing a voting rights bill to the Senate floor. He extended that deadline because of bad weather. But it's moot anyway, because Senator Kyrsten Sinema has announced she's absolutely not going to support changing the Senate rules to get around the Republican filibuster of the voting rights bill. It's also fitting, a bill designed to stop a determined minority from rigging democracy in its favor can't even get a vote because a determined minority of senators is able to block it. Just before the new year, 20 college students in Arizona, Senator Sinema's constituents, tried to illustrate the urgency of the moment with a hunger strike. They met with their senator and later with the White House. And when Schumer set MLK Day as a deadline for a vote on the bill, they suspended their hunger strike. As of this weekend, they are back on strike indefinitely, joined now by faith leaders from around the country. Our producer, Regina Dahir, has been following this movement, which is part of a national campus movement organized by a group called UNPAC. And Regina introduced me to one of the students this past week. We caught up with 19-year-old Michaela Schillinger just as she returned from her winter break at Arizona State University.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet y'all as well. My first day back on campus, had my first two classes today. So
jumping in head first. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Michaela, before we get into the strike itself, I just kind of want to get your reaction to something. We just had our caller.
On our show last week, we talked about a growing feeling among political scientists that it's actually too late to fix our democracy, that it may be past the tipping point. A lot of you called in saying that you shared that feeling. And our guest, Thomas Edsel, who is a New York Times columnist, he said one problem is the absence of the kind of mass student movement and youth activism that played such a huge role in broadening democracy in the first place, back during the Civil Rights Movement. And that resonated for some listeners who lived through the 60s.
And I think of what you're doing with the hunger strike. So I'd love to just hear your reaction to that.
This is a very stressful time in our democracy. And it's scary that we are inheriting such a dysfunctional democracy. A lot of movements on climate change and Black Lives Matter and a lot of other important subjects such as LGBTQ plus rights, women's rights, is mostly led by youth. So they probably just don't realize how many movements are being made by the youth. And youth on college campuses especially has just realized like how effed up everything is. Like, sorry about that, but
it's okay.
How just dysfunctional everything in our country is and in the world is right now. And we are just absolutely terrified of what we will inherit. And in my opinion, not enough youth. I think we need more. But I think, unfortunately, there's just not enough people willing to get into politics right now until you explain to them how urgent these issues are and how our futures are the futures that are hanging in the balance.
And I hear you saying that you feel a responsibility about the world that you are inheriting.
Absolutely.
And I guess I kind of wonder for both you and Regina. I mean, we always talk so much about the youth are going to save us, the youth are going to fix this, and the youth are going to fix that. And I guess I just wonder what that feels like to constantly be on the receiving end of that you're supposed to be the savior.
Sure. It's so funny that you asked that because I was talking to Regina about that in our last call quite a lot. Yeah, it's constantly being said that my generation is going to be the one to save the world. We are going to be the ones to solve climate change. We're going to be the ones to do something about our democracy, about our human rights. You know, everyone says we're going to be the ones to save it all. That is terrifying. That is a lot of pressure. And as much as I want to be the one to save it all, it is really hard going through college, trying to get a degree with the weight of the world on my shoulders. Mm. And I know this goes for so many of my friends and so many other people like me who want to be a part of that change. But like by the time people my age now will be elected into office, like that's still like what, 30 years away, 20 years away. And it's just extremely frustrating because everyone says that we are the people who are going to change the world, but no one wants to listen to us. Mm. No one wants to actually listen to us and make the changes that we are asking for that will save our world. And that is frustrating. That is frustrating and a lot of weight to bear on our backs because, I mean, we literally went on a hunger strike for 15 days. We did not eat. And like, I don't know how else to make that change if physically not eating won't make that change, you know? Like what is there to do bigger than that? And they're still not listening. And so that is extremely scary. But fortunately, as doomsday as it all looks and sounds and feels, we are still fighting. And I think that's the most powerful thing about people my age and about my generation is that we do not care how hard you kick us down. We will stand right back up and keep on fighting.
Although there's the constant criticism of Gen Zs being too sensitive or all asking for too much, the spirit to ask for better and the hope for better is something that I think is really unique and special. And it makes me wonder, Michaela, what made you yourself so interested in voting rights in particular? What drew you to that issue?
What really drove me towards voting rights was understanding that it all starts with voting rights and that we will not be able to even touch climate change, touch human rights, women's rights, LGBTQ rights. We will not be able to touch any of those, you know, immigration rights, gun rights, literally any of it without voting rights. And it all starts there. And I don't think people realize that. I don't think people realize how dysfunctional our voting system is and how hard they make it for us unnecessarily. And the overwhelming majority of voters across the country support the reforms within this act, the Freedom to Vote Act. The partisan divide is in the U.S. Senate and not among the American people. And we will lose our voices in our own country, which is terrifying. I mean, we already live in a dysfunctional democracy. We already live in a democracy where voting is made harder for people of color, for indigenous communities especially. And that should not be happening. We should pride ourselves on every single person being able to vote with ease, no matter their race or ethnicity. But that's not the case in a lot of states.
What was it like when you first heard the idea of moving from organizing purely on campus to something like a hunger strike? What went through your mind when you heard about that idea?
I think when we started talking about escalating, it really set in how important this bill was. I knew it was important, but I was like, I was just thinking, oh, it'll go through. it's not going through. Realizing it's just not happening. And I just think when we started talking about the hunger strike, it really set in how urgent this movement was and how, I mean, I was already scared for my future, but...
But were you scared of not eating? I mean...
Oh.
I hear that, but...
Sure, yeah.
I mean, it's really hard for me to... I've never done a hunger strike, I'll admit, you know?
I hadn't either. I hadn't before this, but not eating, yeah, it was scary. As a college student, I probably don't eat as much as I should. So I was like... I can adjust my diet, you know, because you have to, it's a long process. You have to adjust your diet before. So you get your stomach and your body ready for that kind of fast. And then you have to adjust when you're done too. You have to gradually ease into food and unless you just want to like ruin your body, but.
Like how do you have to adjust before? What do you have to do?
Sure. So, you know, you have to cut out unnatural sugars. We were only allowed to drink water or water with electrolytes in it, but it couldn't have sugars or in it. And then we were only allowed to eat like fruits, vegetables. And then instead of eating, you know, big meals during the day, we had to eat, you know, small portions throughout the day. And by doing so, you get your body ready to fast. So your body doesn't like go into shock. And then during the hunger strike, we were taking supplements and obviously we're staying very, very hydrated and they were monitoring our vitals every, you know, twice a day. And if it got to a point where we were not looking well, they were going to pull us out.
And if I can pause you right there, you're preparing for this hunger strike. You explained that you're really preparing your body for this physical strenuous activity while at the same time preparing for your finals. What was that like? I really couldn't imagine the space you must have been in.
It was very overwhelming. Honestly, it was very physically straining, don't get me wrong, but I think even more, it was mentally straining. And I don't think that any of us couldn't have gotten through it without the support of so many people who started recognizing us and, you know, taking finals with after 2 days of not eating, obviously our brains aren't functioning very well. Some people were still writing essays and just really struggling getting their brain to cooperate with them. And so mentally, it was very draining as well as physically, almost to a point where you kind of just had to desensitize yourself a little bit and just focus on what this was all about. And, you know, a lot of us had loved ones asking us to stop because they were worried about us and they didn't want to put our own health in jeopardy, especially during a pandemic.
What did your family say?
My mom was, she was so happy that I was, you know, part of such a big movement, but it was hard because I could hear the worry in her voice. And, you know, when you hear a parent's worry, you feel guilty, you know, you feel terrible for putting them in that situation. I am very fortunate to grow up with two parents that love me unconditionally and to see them just very worried about, you know, school and my body. But, you know, I would just call her every day and explain to her all the progress that we had been making. And I think that made up for it. I think all of the media attention we got and all the recognition we were getting. And, you know, we talked to Senator Sinema, we talked with senior advisors from the White House, we talked to Mark Kelly, you know, we were making a lot of progress that has not been made. that made up for it. It was comforting to her almost, and to me. And it was just like, it's worth it. But for a lot of my peers and friends, their parents were not happy. They wanted them to stop.
I'm sure. I think my mom would definitely be in that camp.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the public support that you got, and you got a lot of support from very notable names like Kerry Washington, Mark Ruffalo, Leonardo DiCaprio, just to name a few. What did that public support mean to you and your fellow strikers? And what was the conversations like amongst you all doing the strike at the time?
I think personally, my initial reactions were very much like fangirling. I was like, oh my God, they know what I look like. But it brought moments of clarity for sure, because we knew we were finally being heard. And that it's an indescribable feeling, because it reassured us that what we were doing mattered and that what we were doing was the right thing, which was very important. We're greatly appreciative of that support.
When we talked with Michaela last week, President Biden had just given his big voting rights speech down in Georgia. There was still some hope that the Senate would hold a vote tomorrow. But after Kyrsten Sinema dashed those hopes, Michaela and her fellow students returned to Washington, D.C. and resumed their hunger strike. We reached out to her earlier today. Michaela, hey.
Hi.
So what is the scene down there? How many of you are there on strike?
Yeah, so our group has nearly doubled in size. We are at about 40 young people now hunger striking, putting their bodies on the line with us.
And you're joined by faith leaders as well?
Yes, we are joined by faith leaders who have been striking about a week longer than us, started their strike last week. And we have also been joined by young people across the country striking in their homes, doing 48-hour hunger strikes in, with us to show their support. And
I know from our last conversation that it was a scary thought that you'd have to do this again. What would you like to say to your senator?
The fact that we have to do this again is a little mind-blowing, honestly. I think all of us were quite speechless, but at the same time, I think it's what we expected, unfortunately. MLK weekend is here, and because, one of the senators, I think it was Brian Schatz of Hawaii, tested positive for COVID, and due to the impending winter storm, I mean, it's currently snowing outside right now, it's 25 degrees. The vote has been rescheduled to take place on Tuesday, January 18th, instead of MLK Day. But I want to reiterate that we are not stopping our strike. We are not pausing our strike. We are motivated and still standing strong, aren't taking any breaks, and we will still be not eating, even though they have adjourned for the weekend. Mm.
You didn't eat for 15 days last time, and you kept going until they scheduled the vote. How long are you going to be striking this time, or what needs to happen for you to come off strike?
Sure. So they need to debate the now Freedom to Vote John Lewis Act on the Senate floor for us possibly to end our strike. But we are striking indefinitely as of now.
Mm. How do you feel?
I'm very hungry. I'm very tired. I'm very scared. I'm very sad. It's also just been a whole nother level of hard because of how cold it's been here on the East Coast. I know especially the students from Arizona and Florida are struggling with this cold weather. You know, our cold was 68 degrees and now it's 25 and snowing, like I said. Yesterday, we did a press conference at Dr. Martin Luther King's memorial.
we had a striker nearly faint. We have strikers with concerning abdominal pains. Some have migraines. Personally, I wake up every morning and I go to bed every night with a lot of nausea and really bad headaches, a little dizziness, and that's just kind of what I'm feeling. But I
are you
think
hopeful? That, I mean, are you hopeful that this is going to work?
I am a lot more hopeful when I hear all the people who speak at these press conferences. You know, such as the faith leaders, they have really, really inspired all of us and me personally, and have put a new sense of hope in me personally. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, going into this weekend, you know, we started Thursday. And then with everything that went on this weekend, I felt very hopeless. Mm. And I was like, I was confused. I was like, what's going on? But at the same time, it was to be expected, right? And, you know, I'm trying to put the hopeless feeling aside and just really dig into the hope that all the people around me are giving me. Yeah. And I'm really feeding off of other people's optimistic energy. And I think that it really... being scared and terrified for all of our futures together brings a sense of hopefulness, because I know that I'm surrounded by like-minded people who want to change our democracy to be functional just as much as I do.
Michaela Schillinger is a sophomore at Arizona State University and a student organizer with Unpack. She and 40 other students are on hunger strike in Washington, D.C. on behalf of voting rights right now. Michaela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Sound designed by Jared Paul. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frillman, and Kusha Navidar. I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And of course, hope you'll join us for the live show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, take care of yourselves. Thanks for listening.